Iowa is facing an insect invasion. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day, and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here. The state has been monitoring the gypsy moth for nearly 40 years, and all signs point to a population explosion in the very near future. We'll talk about gypsy moths and the dangers they pose to Iowa's forests and trees. We'll also talk about how we can control the population. Also, the presence of emerald ash borer has been confirmed on an island in the Mississippi River. Now that the pest has reached the border, we'll find out what we can expect it to do. Later on, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will be here, and he and Donald will answer your questions about plants and bugs. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and although there are no bugs buzzing around outside, there have been plenty of bugs in the news lately. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will be joining us shortly to answer your questions about plants, but we're going to start off with insects today. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here. Hello, Donald.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
Doing great. The sun is out. It's a beautiful day.
It is, at least for now.
We'll take it.
Yep. The state has been monitoring gypsy moths for 40 years, waiting to find out if that pest was going to cause a lot of problems in the state of Iowa. And now it looks like there is going to be a population explosion in the near future. Donald, where did gypsy moths come from?
Well, the original ones came from Europe. And that happened in Massachusetts back in 1869. So this is not a new pest to the continent, but the gypsy moth infestation that started in Massachusetts way back on the Atlantic seaboard that many years ago, very slowly on its own, spread across the Atlantic seaboard into Pennsylvania, New York, into Ohio. Unfortunately, the gypsy moth jumped into Michigan back in 1975, and the Michigan infestation slowly moved up the lower peninsula, across the upper peninsula of Michigan and back down into Wisconsin. And that slow movement around the top of the lake is the apparent source of our current concerns in Iowa. The Wisconsin population has now apparently moved that last little bit of Wisconsin and crossed the river into the northeast corner of Iowa.
So what problems do they cause?
The gypsy moth is a caterpillar in its immature stages, and in the months of May and June, those caterpillars eat the leaves off of trees, and they prefer oak. Out of the dozens of species that they will eat, they love to eat the leaves off of oak trees, and the loss of oak foliage is a temporary setback for the tree, and when that happens repeatedly, year after year after year, the oak trees can begin to die off. And that's what we saw back in Pennsylvania and New York back in the mid-previous century. And that's the fear that we have here. In addition to losing trees, there's just the inconvenience of defoliation. There's the loss of shade. There's the loss of habitat. In urban areas, of course, we plant lots of oaks around our houses. And it's also a people pest. Interestingly, the gypsy moth makes campgrounds and your backyard a pretty disgusting place when caterpillars 2 inches in length are eating leaves as fast as they can and converting it into fecal pellets that drop onto your picnic table. So there are lots of reasons to hate the gypsy moth, but mostly it's the protection of our natural resource that we're worried about.
Is the damage that has been done on the eastern seaboard to oaks there, did that wipe out oak populations, or is that a relatively short-lived problem?
There has been subtle changes in the composition of the forests. I suppose most people who drive through Pennsylvania and New York and the Atlantic seaboard say, I see plenty of trees. I can see the forest for the trees. There have been subtle changes in the composition, and because oaks are so valuable as a natural resource for wildlife, they're so valuable as a lumber species, we really don't want to lose them, is the point. So it's not a total wipeout. The forests don't disappear, but they do subtly change.
Do they just eat oaks, or do they like other kinds of trees as well?
There's a long, long list of what they will eat. And, of course, when you start adding up everything that a gypsy moth has ever been found to munch, the list grows to 500 different species of trees and shrubs. But we always come back to the fact that if given a choice, if there's a variety of trees in the area, they will eat the oak foliage first.
So they would prefer the oak, start with that, and then move on.
And then move on to things like our basswoods and birch, the hornbeam, serviceberry, which is common in our Iowa landscapes and in the woodlands. Apple trees as well. Orchardists will worry about this because those are on the favored list as well.
All right. So we've had a century to watch these insects move across the nation. And, of course, we've had a long time to study them as well. What can we do to control a gypsy moth population before it gets to a crisis level?
Well, we have had a monitoring program in Iowa since 1970, and this is the pheromone traps, the little green boxes that the federal and state government puts into campgrounds. And we have caught gypsy moths occasionally since 1989 here in the state, but every time it was just a vagabond, it was a hitchhiker, it was a small problem, it wasn't a massive infestation that led, or massive invasion that led to an infestation. So we have been monitoring on the state level. The state also cooperates with the federal government in a project called Slow the Spread. This is your federal tax dollars at work to look at that border where the gypsy moth is established and where it is moving into, and using federal tax dollars when they are available to treat that area. So the agencies involved have been working on this. As individuals, all we can do is play by the rules, inspect campers and recreational vehicles and so other items coming out of infested areas so that we aren't responsible for any transport, follow the firewood quarantine regulations and so forth. But when gypsy moth gets here, when it is a full-blown infestation within the state, it will fall to individuals to do what they can and what they want to do to protect the foliage on the trees during that period.
When you say treat that area, are you talking about insecticides?
In this case, we have several tools in our toolbox that we can use. And the popular choice for this zone of transition between infested and not infested has been to use aerial drops of male pheromone, that airplanes fly over this transition zone where the gypsy moth might be moving into, and they drop male pheromone. And the saturation of male pheromone so confuses the male moth that they no longer find and mate with the female moth. The females then cannot lay fertile eggs. Eggs don't hatch into caterpillars, and there's no defoliation. So by using this trick of nature, using these sex pheromones, the chemicals that insects use for communication with other members of the same species, we're able to reduce the population in those areas. This does not work as well where there's a heavy infestation, but it's one of the things that has been very popular for this slow the spread activity.
Do we have plans to pursue that pathway in Iowa?
We have proposals to pursue that pathway. The gypsy moth trapping program of the last several years, and especially last year when there was a tremendous increase in the number of gypsy moth males caught in the trapping program, indicates there may be a couple of hot spots where it's more likely the gypsy moth is trying to establish in northeast Iowa than elsewhere. And at the moment, the Slow the Spread Foundation, in cooperation with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, is looking at a proposal to treat those two areas in northeast Iowa. Of course, that's going to require money, and that money has not yet been allocated. But if money were to become available, a pheromone treatment program would take place this coming May and June up in the northeast corner of the state.
Now, the gypsy moth population tends to go through cycles of 7 to 10 years before or between huge population outbreaks. How do we predict that if we're controlling the population with pheromones?
You've hit on the golden point there, that if you treat the population that year, you cannot monitor the population. So you have to make your treatment, wait a year, and go back and find out if it was effective. You get no immediate feedback in this particular program of treating the male population with the pheromones. Now, the moth flights are later in the season than the caterpillars, of course, and so the aerial application of pheromone comes in the middle of the summer, as opposed to trying to kill caterpillars while they're eating the trees in May and June, and that may not have been completely clear in the earlier statement. So it's hard to measure results because you can't do it immediately. You have to wait for a generation to develop to see if it develops and come back to it that way.
Is there precedent set from other states who've used that kind of control in the past? I mean, can we actually prevent a huge population explosion, or are we just delaying it?
I think delaying it, slowing the spread, the name of the foundation pretty much says the best they can do, that on its own, the gypsy moth would spread several miles per year. And the success of the Slow the Spread program, going back into the 1990s, has been very encouraging. It doesn't eliminate the gypsy moth. It just delays the invasion, slows the spread, gives you more time to diversify your landscape or whatever else seems useful to you. But it has worked in something like a 1,200-mile-long border that extends from Wisconsin down to Tennessee, where the gypsy moth is still moving to the west and to the south from the established populations.
It seems to me the greatest danger is to Iowa's oak hickory forests, which are, of course, endangered already.
We have lots of problems to worry about, everything from droughts to floods to invasive species of all kinds. And it just seems like some days things are ganging up on us, doesn't it?
It does start to feel that way, especially if you talk to Mark Vitosh about all the things threatening trees.
Well, yeah, and as an urban forester, he sees what we do to trees as well. So
right, right.
Everything seems to fall on the trees.
Well, we will talk a little bit more about insects in a moment. We're going to leave the gypsy moth unless you have any questions, but we're also going to talk about the emerald ash borer, which has been identified on an island in the Mississippi, so they are getting nearer and nearer all the time. We'll take your questions about insects. We'll also take your questions about plants. Richard Geron will be joining us after our break, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. And, of course, Donald Lewis will still be with us from Iowa State University Extension Entomology. You can join the conversation. Our phone number is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with us today are Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. We've been talking about the gypsy moth. We'll move on to the emerald ash borer here in a moment. And also with us is Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Geron. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
How much snow is your garden buried under right now?
Not as much as it could be. Maybe 8 to 10 inches, possibly.
Oh, that's good. That's
we
good.
Didn't get as much as eastern Iowa.
No,
so
no. And, of course, the groundhog is predicting an early spring, so that's...
Yes. He had to. If he didn't, his life would have been in danger,
right,
I think.
I think that's true. Yeah, our garden is... We don't have a windbreak on our property. We're out in the middle of nowhere, and so the snow swept all over the place, except we did have a bit of a windbreak by the garden, and so our garden is under an 8-foot drift. So it's going to take a while for us to get down to the soil, I think, this spring.
Better to drift onto the garden than the driveway.
Yes, it's true. If you'd like to join our conversation today, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. iowafromiowa.org. And before we move on from invasive species and insects today, Donald, the emerald ash borer has been confirmed on an island in the Mississippi River. So here it is at the border. What can we expect to see in the next year or so?
Well, we've been watching the emerald ash borer in the United States since 2002, when the first infestations were identified in Detroit, Michigan, and it's been this pop-up of freckles on the map as people moved firewood around the United States, not so much the beetle just flying on its own, but instead moving firewood around, and we watched it move into Ohio and Indiana and into Illinois. And a year ago, 2 years ago now, we found emerald ash borer in Wisconsin in a couple of places. And one of them was across the Mississippi River from Allamaquee County in the northeast corner of the state. It was found in St. Paul. It was in a couple of other areas in Minnesota. And then last year, the emerald ash borer was detected on an island in the Mississippi River, 2 miles south of the Minnesota border, which puts it across the river from this Wisconsin infestation that we had known about for some time. So they went up, they tore apart ash trees until they found the emerald ash borer. They documented that it was Iowa soil. It's an island on our side of the Mississippi River. And then we continued the monitoring program throughout the state, focusing again on eastern Iowa primarily. And at the end of last year, there had been no additional discoveries of emerald ash borer anywhere in Iowa. So an island is infested in the Mississippi River, but to our knowledge, nowhere else in the state. We will maintain vigilance. We will continue to work with the public who thinks they have an ash tree in trouble, or they think they have seen a shiny green beetle on their ash trees. We will continue to monitor the activities of the Iowa and the U.S. Departments of Agriculture and the Iowa Department of Natural Resources as they continue the monitoring program to try to detect additional infestations in the state.
So we're still in the wait-and-see phase of this. Do you really think that that it's going to take long for that insect to cross the river, though?
Well, I think we have been very fortunate that we don't have it already, so I'm a bit bolstered by the fact that we have dodged this bullet now for a couple few years. The previous infestation prior to the one at Victory, Wisconsin, across the Mississippi River was La Salle, Peru, Illinois, which is only 90 miles from Iowa. And a truckload of firewood could be in the state within 2 hours and bring us emerald ash borer. If emerald ash borer were left on its own, it would take decades for it to reach from Allamaquee County to Des Moines and central Iowa. But a truckload of firewood could arrive here tomorrow, and we would have the infestation. So there's this huge unknown, and there's no way to predict which of those two scenarios it's going to be. So sometime between tomorrow and 30 years from now, we will probably have the emerald ash borer in most of the rest of the state.
Now, I, of course, spent the last decade in Michigan, so I watched as millions of ash trees were killed by the emerald ash borer, and you can really see the impact all across the state of Michigan. In Iowa, clearly, people are expecting this to happen, and I've heard that on Iowa State University's campus, they're actually beginning to remove ash trees because they consider it to be inevitable.
I think that's probably right. The inevitable seems a little fatalistic for my half-full view of life, but I think the evidence is pretty clear that what happened in Michigan and Ohio and Indiana is going to happen here sooner or later. If it were to happen all at once, we would lose all of the ash trees at the same time. And one of the very few proactive things that a city, a homeowner, a campus, a community can do is to start now to diversify your landscape. And as we look at the Iowa woodlands, we see maybe as low as 5%, maybe up to 20% of the forested areas are ash trees. As we look at our cities and campuses, we realize 20 to 50% of our tree coverage may be ash trees. If there's a way we can diversify now ahead of the problem, we're just that further off when we do have, further ahead when we do have to take down ash trees when the emerald ash borer gets here.
If you'd like to join our conversation today, if you have any plant questions, maybe you've been perusing a seed catalog or a nursery catalog, you want to know if something will grow here in Iowa, you'd like to get Richard's take on it, give us a call at 866-780-9100. That number again, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Donald, of course, there are ash trees all over in Iowa, but we're not a heavily forested state. And in Michigan, of course, these insects could move from tree to tree pretty easily because there are a whole lot of trees in Michigan. If they do come to Iowa, will they be less able to move around because there are large areas of land without trees in between ash trees?
It's logical to assume that the insect will have a more difficult time jumping large expanses of corn and soybeans, but I think it's not a good bet to bet against the insects. So they will make it, but it may be a slower process. It may take a little more time, but insects are going to survive. They are going to perpetuate the species. Those females will get to the host plant that supports their offspring. So maybe with a little difficulty, a little longer time lag, they will eventually get across the state. But you're right. We have these vast expanses of corn and soybeans and concrete that will help to slow them down, but not forever.
Well, that makes me a little more hopeful for the big ash tree right outside my house. There aren't other ash trees in the area, so we'll see.
Well, and that we saw that with Dutch elm disease, of course. There were escapes of the American elm. Some towns lost all of them, but then occasionally there would be this isolated elm that is still there. And also looking at Dutch elm disease, we know there were treatments that could be put into those trees. And when there is a specimen, high-value ash tree that is extremely healthy and extremely important, there are injections that can be made. Just realize that you're talking probably $50 to $200 per tree per year for the rest of your life. Now, maybe treatments will get better. Maybe that won't be that much expense every year forever. Maybe we will come up with better treatments. But one of the things people are asking about is, should I be treating my ash trees? Our answer is not now, because there's no evidence you have emerald ash borer near your tree. But when you hear of emerald ash borer within 15 to 20 miles of that tree, then you can consider which trees justify treatment, which trees justify replacement, and make those decisions at that time.
Well, and that was Larry in Independence. He sent us an email with just that question, asking whether he should pre-treat his ash tree. He says it's the only shade he has for his house. So maybe it's not necessarily time to pre-treat, but also time to plant something else.
That's right. And now's the time to diversify. It's going to be hard to grow another tree near where you have that ash tree. Trees don't grow in the shade of other trees very well. But getting trees started is one of the things we can do to help minimize that impact if and when we lose that tree. People are treating their ash trees. There are people who are just so paranoid. They are so anxious and so upset at the thought of losing the tree that they will start spending that money now, which doesn't seem prudent to us until the insect is closer to us. It can be done. It just isn't logical to do it yet. But certainly diversify with other species adapted to the area is an important first step for now.
All right. Stephen is on the line in Fort Atkinson at 866-780-9100. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, hello. How do you do today?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I want to talk about another tree, the American chestnut, that had the same type of problem years and years and years ago. I'm curious if your expert there can tell me about the prevalence of American chestnut trees in Iowa, more particularly northeast Iowa, the presence of blight, and what the likelihood that a blight-resistant American chestnut seedling from New York State would survive in this neck of the woods.
Well, I don't believe they were native to Iowa. You do see them occasionally. There's one on campus here at Iowa State. In the case of chestnut blight, it will kill the mature tree, but it won't kill the root system. And so it will send up suckers, and they will grow for a number of years, get big enough, and eventually die themselves. So the actual tree never dies completely. There are some new trees out there, hybrids, that are about like maybe 95% American chestnut.
Sure.
With a small part of, I think, Chinese chestnut. And those are being planted across the country, like in Tennessee. And they might be a tree that to try in Iowa. We don't really know yet how well it's going to do, but it's a possibility.
Well, I know some folks that have the hybrid trees, and they do pretty well down in the Quad Cities area. But I've sourced a 100% fourth generation seedling of a 100% American chestnut, and my thought was that because the American chestnut tree wasn't native to this area, the blight wouldn't be here, and they might stand a greater chance of surviving with 100% American chestnut genetics.
Yeah, it's here because we do have a few scattered trees in landscapes, basically. So it's here, like here on campus at Iowa State. So,
yes, sir.
It's kind of a risky, but it's worth a try.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
All right. And, Stephen, let us know how it turns out.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Dennis in Moline, Illinois, has a question for you, Donald. He says, I inject my oak trees each spring for oak borers. Would that possibly control gypsy moth as well?
Injections for oak borers. That's probably an imidacloprid. It's not a sure thing. There may be some residual effect of that insecticide, and we would need to know which one it is and the size of the trees and a few other variables. But the borers that he's trying to control are in the wood of the tree, in the cambium area, and the insecticide is moving past them in the vascular system. In order for that insecticide to kill the caterpillars of the gypsy moth, the insecticide has to make it out into the foliage and be at a high enough concentration early enough in the season. And I think those are formidable challenges to get the insecticide up the tree into the foliage by the time the caterpillars are feeding. I don't think this is a sure bet. I think if it were that simple, it would already be done across the eastern United States. I'm not 100% sure why we don't do that, but I don't think that's going to work as well.
All right. We have an email from Dan in Ames. He says, I'm planning on starting plants for my garden indoors and constructing a growth system in the basement to be lit with fluorescent lighting. Could you recommend a proper level of illumination? My thought is to use a combination of daylight CFLs, a compact fluorescence, with fluorescent daylight tube shop lighting. What do you think, Richard?
You can just use ordinary shop fixtures and put in two 40-watt tubes. I would put in a cool white tube and a warm white tube, and so they can be fairly inexpensive. The main thing on using those is when you place the plants underneath them, they should be just a few inches above the plants, so like 4 or 5, 6 inches. So they shouldn't be hanging 2 or 3 feet above the plant. So make them sure they're close to the actual seedlings and have them on for 12 to 14 hours per day. And that's fairly inexpensive and does a very good job.
And what do you need to worry about as far as temperatures go if you're in a basement? Is it going to be too cool?
It may be for germination. Typically, for most seeds, you'd like to have a medium temperature around 70 to 75. But once the actual seedlings come up, then if you have cooler temperatures, that's okay. So let's say the temperatures in the growing area is around 60, 65. That's okay for seedlings. But as far as germination, no. What you might want to do is you could either use a heat mat, which you can buy, or you can place the actual flat near a heat source, like a furnace vent, and it'll be warmer there. So.
All right. Roger from Des Moines has a question for you, Donald. He says, I'm wondering if there are natural predators of the gypsy moth that might be helpful and that we could encourage.
Certainly. And predators and parasites both have been the subject of long-term research studies by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They are the only ones who can bring natural enemies from the native range of the insect, the invasive insect, into this country. So the problems with gypsy moth in the eastern United States used to be very extensive, millions of acres of defoliation every year. But over time, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has brought predators and parasites from Europe that cleared all of the tests, cleared all of the hurdles to be released in the United States. They brought those to this country and released them into infested areas, and it appears that those older infestations of gypsy moth in the eastern United States are dampened quite a bit by these natural enemies. That will happen here, but the natural enemies don't come right away, so there's frequently a lag time. But yes, the biological controls, the natural enemies, will be part of our ecosystem if the gypsy moth establishes here. It may take some time to happen.
Now, of course, in the past, that kind of control has led to some other problems because sometimes new invasive species get introduced. Are we more careful today about what kinds of predators we import?
Nobody wants to be the person who brings in the next multiflora rose. Mistakes have happened. Starlings and sparrows and even crabgrass. I believe dandelion was an imported species. So mistakes have happened. But in the insect world, the Beltsville, Maryland laboratory of the U.S. Department of Agriculture has this huge screening facility where these kinds of tests are made to make sure it doesn't happen again. So we keep our fingers crossed that everybody's doing their job and that that job keeps the invasive species away. So I trust them. I think this has been a good program.
All right. My guests today are Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and horticulturist Richard Giron. We're taking your calls on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me are Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and ISU Extension entomologist Donald Lewis, and they're here to answer your questions about plants or bugs, whatever's on your mind. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you could tweet us at IPRTalk, and Carol is on the line from Carol. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Linda is in much more exotic climes, but I know she would know this answer. But I got to let you guys answer it. I am starting to get the garden catalogs, like you were talking about. And I noticed this year, I did not notice this last year, they're beginning to print the hardiness zone right along with your address. I think probably based on zip code.
Okay.
The problem is I'm getting two different zones.
Okay.
In my addresses. What's going on and which one should I trust? I mean, zone 5, it's very different from zone 3.
Well, you're definitely not in zone 3. Northern Iowa is in zone 4.
Well, I'm calling from Carroll, but right. I live, my garden is in southwest, the southwest corner.
Of Iowa.
Of Iowa.
Okay. Well, northern Iowa is in zone 4, and in zone 4, the average minimum temperature is minus 20 to minus 30. Southern Iowa is in zone 5, and typically what I say is anything north of Highway 20 is definitely zone 4, and anything south of Interstate 80 is basically zone 5. And anything in between is kind of, it depends. Okay?
Kind of iffy.
Right. For example, here in Ames, I consider the city of Ames to be in Zone 5. Now, some rural areas in Story County, because it's very, very open and very exposed, you might consider Zone 4 just because they get colder temperatures. So
right.
It kind of depends.
And I used to live in Ames, as a matter of fact. So. Okay, but definitely not Zone 3.
Definitely not. That is Minnesota and I think northern South Dakota and North Dakota. So, no. So, now there was a hardiness map that was formulated recently that has not won acceptance. And so that may cause some confusion. But the hardiness zone that we go by now was formulated by the USDA in 1990.
Okay. Every once in a while, maybe once a month, would you talk about what our hardiness zone is for people who don't listen every single week?
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll try. We'll try to do that, Carol. Thanks a lot for your call.
Bye.
So do you think that the hardiness zones are in flux, Richard, as things are changing?
Maybe a little bit, but I would still stick by those. Those are still pretty good tools to go by. The recent one that was formulated, I think, was based on the warmer weather recently. But you have to, I think, look at weather over a longer time frame to get a true idea of our hardiness and cold temperatures.
And you never go wrong by choosing a plant from a lower hardiness
right.
zone.
Absolutely not. Right. So
right.
If in doubt, always go for the lower one.
All right. Next up, we've got John in Waterloo. Hello, John.
Hi. Good morning. I was wondering about the prospects for elm trees. If I was, I got an ash that I want to kind of look forward that maybe at some point it'll probably fail. And I was wondering about where you could get them and if how they would do over the longer, 20, 30 years.
Well, they are being planted now. There are basically two types. We have the hybrids. They have been around for a number of years. These are hybrids. They're partly American elms and partly some other elm species. So I'll have the hybrids. But we also have some true American elms that have been developed that are Dutch elm disease resistant. So you have those two options. You have the hybrids and you have the true American elms that are Dutch elm resistant. So I would visit my garden center, see if they have some of those. And we can definitely plant those.
All right, John, thanks a lot for your call. And we've got an email from Holly. She says, I recently discovered an infestation of scale on the lower leaves of my variegated rubber plant. I removed the lower leaves and have been treating the leaves and stems with alcohol. I'd like to know if scale live in the soil and if air layering the plant and starting over with fresh soil would be a good idea.
Well, certainly divisions and propagation are always a good idea. No, scale insects do not live in the soil. They are attached to the foliage. Starting over with fresh soil doesn't affect the insects, but it may be good for the plant. Air layering is a way to get a new plant, but it doesn't guarantee you that it will be scale-free. Oftentimes, scale infestations occur at very, very low levels, almost below what we can detect. And then you hit a spell of dry weather in the winter, or you hit warmer temperatures, something happens and the scale population explodes. And even though it's been there all along, suddenly we notice it. So your propagation material has to be scale free in order for her process to work. But assuming that, yes, that is a good way to move on and move forward and maintain the plant.
All right. And next up, we've got Jean on the line from Solon at 866-780-9100. Hello, Jean.
Hi. I have a neighbor who has a volunteer peach tree that has the most exquisite, flavorful peaches. And I would like to know the best way to take one of those peaches and get a tree of my own, whether I plant a whole peach, a fresh peach pit, a dried out fruit. Peach pit, what's the best way to go?
Okay, the neighbor's tree, is that a volunteer or something they bought?
No, it was a volunteer.
Okay. Well, what you can do is take a fruit, remove that seed or pit, and then plant the seed in the fall.
Okay, so it would the pit would have dried out by that point.
Right, so take your fruit, remove the seeds or pits,
mm-hmm.
Just store them somewhere until fall,
mm-hmm.
and then plant them in the fall. You have to plant them in the fall because for the seeds to germinate, they need to be exposed to cold temperatures.
Uh-huh.
And in the ground, they'll do that. So they'll be exposed to the cold. Plant those about an inch, maybe inch and a half deep.
Okay.
And do it in the fall, and hopefully they'll germinate in the spring. Now, if you were to take a seed from a cultivated tree, let's say your neighbor had purchased a peach tree.
Mm-hmm.
That's a variety.
Right.
And when you plant the seed from that, that's not going to give you exactly the same thing.
Right.
But if this tree is a volunteer, yeah, it should be much like the volunteer itself.
Okay, great. Well, I will give this a try. Thank
you so much.
All
right, good luck with that, Gene.
Thanks.
All right, thanks a lot for your call. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Ehrlich from Fairfield's on the line next. Hello.
Hi. I love the show.
Thanks.
I grew up in the East Coast, and we had something called tent caterpillars. And they were everywhere. I mean, we were in the middle of forest and everything, and it seems like every tree every summer had it, and we used torches to burn them out and so forth. And we've been in Iowa for many decades now, and we have what seems to be the same thing. Are these tent caterpillars, quote-unquote, the same thing as these gypsy moths? And right now I go into our crabs and our apple trees, and I just tear them out mechanically and get rid of them.
No, they are not the same. One of the things about the gypsy moth is that it makes no webbing. There are no tents at the fork of the branches. There is no webbing over the ends of the branches. And there's no cocoon around the pupa. The one you're talking about is officially known as the eastern tent caterpillar. We find that only on apples, crab apples, and trees and shrubs in the genus Prunus, P-R-U-N-U-S. Prunus includes choke cherry and purple leaf sand cherry and cherry. So it's that very small number of trees and shrubs where we find this eastern tent caterpillar. Eastern tent caterpillar makes that tent at the fork of the branch in April and May, and scraping it down and wadding it up and throwing it away is a perfectly acceptable control. Generally, control is not essential to the tree's health. They survive this early defoliation without any problem, but to make the tree look better, we take them down and throw them away. I'd have to tell you that everybody in Extension embroiders it on their pillow. ISU Extension does not recommend fire for insect control. There's just too many ways for fire to go wrong, including hurting the tree by burning the bark with your blowtorch and doing more damage than the caterpillars did by temporarily removing the leaves from the top of the tree. So I'm glad you got away with it. My dad got away with it. I'm glad it works for some of the people some of the time, but fire is just one of those things that has a lot of ways to go wrong when it's applied to trees.
All right. Thanks so much for your call. And so you all embroider it into your pillows? That's an interesting way to take a vow.
I haven't gotten one of those
yet. You know, it's just one of those things. If you really want to remember it, you embroider it, I guess.
All right. Thanks so much for your call. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. And next up, we've got Dave in Des Moines. Hello, Dave.
Hi, folks. I have two beautiful sycamore trees in a new house I just bought, and I got a notice to trim them as they were overhanging the right-of-way. And the fella I got assured me that he was an artist, but he was not. And my wife was devastated. He cut some really nice big limbs. About how long do you think it's going to take for suckers to fill in and for that tree to come back with any kind of cover?
Without seeing, it's hard to say.
Yeah.
If it's been pruned severely, it may be several years before it really kind of grows back and looks nice again. But on the other hand, they do grow fairly rapidly.
Right.
So you might be surprised that maybe in a year or two, it might look pretty much back to normal. So depending
let's
on how badly it was, let's say, butchered, it really is going to determine how quickly it recovers. So as long as it has a nice sturdy trunk,
yes,
some nice sturdy branches on it, then I think it has the chance to recover within a few years.
Okay, because this is going to be on me for those few years because I hired the guy.
But next time, what you might want to do is possibly go to the phone book, look at tree care companies, tree care services, look for certain things that tends to suggest they're quite knowledgeable. I would look for years of experience. I would look for individuals that belong to a professional society. like the Iowa Arborist Association, I would look for cues that would give me some idea of their experience and knowledge.
All right. Well, good luck. Better luck next time, Dave. Thanks a lot for your call. And we have an email from Judith in Des Moines. She says, last year at this time, I planted seeds indoors for tomatoes and peppers. As they grew, I noticed white flies on them, which became difficult to control with just insecticidal soap. After they were planted in the garden, the white flies increased and were present all summer, something I've never seen before in my garden. I'd like to avoid this problem this year. Any tips as to how to control white flies on the young plants?
It is difficult, and part of the problem with the insecticidal soap is it's only a contact insecticide. It must touch the underside of the leaf, and when you have those little transplants that are barely taller than the edge of the pot or barely taller than the edge of the tray they are in, spraying upward to hit the undersides of the leaves is difficult, but that's what has to be done, and insecticidal soap is a good choice in that situation. You buy that at the garden center. You mix it up according to label directions, and remember, it only hurts what it hits, so you have to be creative with your applications. Indoors, we have few white flies, but they can move from your house plants to your bedding plants. And certainly when you buy them from the greenhouse, you may import them, though greenhouses do such a great job of insect control anymore. It's hard for an entomologist to even find any white flies to study. So the chances are very slim. And let's just say 2010 was a white fly fluke, and we're not counting on it to happen again for her.
All right. Well, that's good news. And Casey's on the line in Iowa City with a question for you, Donald. Hi, Casey.
Hello. As part of the fateful Straight Line Winds class, the tree stewardship program, for years I received and put out gypsy moth traps. I really never heard why we quit doing that.
I don't know either. They used to use lots of volunteers in the gypsy moth trapping program. I think the trapping became more targeted as the budgets became more restrictive. I think they tried to whittle down the number of traps we could use. I recall we used to use 7,000 of these gypsy moth traps around the state, and for the last few years, it's dropped to 4,000 or 5,000, and I think money might be the driving factor.
And yes, there's probably more there were several of us in the county that took the tree stewardship program, and I thought that's how there's probably other people who are still trapping in Johnson County then.
The Johnson County is still being trapped, yes, and it's probably fewer than maybe in the past, but they were put in high-risk areas like campgrounds and parks and areas where people are likely to pull off the interstate and introduce a gypsy moth from east of here. I think budgets have driven a lot of these decisions, and I don't know that was DNR, USDA's, EIDL's decision, but even something like the community tree steward that was so popular and so effective has fallen on hard times as budgets have been cut. So I wish we had the money to do these kinds of things, because it was a great effort and involved a lot of people and kept them informed and motivated to think about gypsy moth.
All right, Casey, thank you so much for your call. And we are out of time today. And I have to mention that the conversation about emerald ash borers and gypsy moths brought up a lot of questions about trees today. And we will be talking trees again in 2 weeks. Forester Mark Vitosh will be here along with Richard Geron. So we'll answer tree questions 2 weeks from now on Talk of Iowa. Donald Lewis, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And Richard Geron, thank you.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Geron. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Russell Mansky in Ames. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. And, of course, you can send us email anytime. The email address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Monday on the show, scenes from an impending marriage with Adrian Tomeen and also traditional weddings in the Heartland. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.